right, we have one case on our 10 o'clock docket, Stewart versus Langdon. Ms. Spisak. Mr. Thompson.
Good morning. I'm Jeffrey Thompson. It's my privilege this morning to represent Lyndon Stewart, who's here with me, and most of his family. I think they're here to break my legs if I do this wrong, but they wanted to come watch, and so they're here. I think the briefing in this case probably covers most of the legal issues, but there are some things that I want to address with you because of their impact on those legal issues. In our argument and authorities section on page 4, in our brief, we make it very clear that we are going to refer to a document and to a preemptive right to purchase as a right of first refusal, or ROFR. We go on to say that our position and contention is that the instrument involved in this case is neither a valid nor enforceable right of first refusal and option to purchase the property at issue. And we ask you to consider that references to Exhibit P1 as an ROFR is not intended to suggest in any manner that we agree that the instrument creates a preemptive right to purchase the property, and we specifically deny that it does. And I'm going to be talking about that particular document with you, and in rereading the briefing, the idea comes across that, well, perhaps there's an admission here that there really is an ROFR, a right of first refusal, and our position is there simply is not. The law is very clear that a valid preemptive right to purchase requires the property owner, before selling it to another, to offer to the right holder on the terms and conditions specified in the contract granting the right. Now, I have given you two documents that I've marked up in color, so that, and the color is there primarily so I can tell you, look at the yellow, look at the green, rather than trying to direct you to where it is. But I want to talk about the option to purchase real estate first. And I think when we walk through this option, we will see very clearly that this document is not a right of first refusal. It is not an enforceable option to purchase. It is illusory in its entirety. It is paper and nothing more. And the fact that it has been on file in the deed records in Hood County for some period of time does not give it any enforceability.
Okay, so let me get this straight. You are challenging the validity of a contract to which you are not a party.
Absolutely.
What is your standing to do that?
The standing is provided in Abraham versus Payne. In that case, there was a challenge to a right of first refusal, and the court held that because at page 524, the court says, whether or not AIC, one of the parties, was entitled to fulfillment of its contract was dependent upon whether Campbell properly exercised his preferential right to purchase. That being so, AIC clearly had standing to bring suit to determine that question. So the Abraham versus Payne case says that we have standing. Further, it's obvious that since we had a fully executed and delivered contract, the only way that the seller can avoid conveying the property pursuant to that contract is if she is somehow legally excused. She is no longer free to go out and make a new deal with either the person who has his name on this option to purchase or with anyone else. So unless there...
Isn't your remedy a suit for specific performance?
Yes. We're entitled to... Since the Langdons purchased the property with full knowledge of our contract, they took it subject to our rights. And we were not... They did not cut off our rights under that contract by the exercise of a valid right of first refusal, and they did not cut off our rights pursuant to a valid option to purchase. Okay? So let's look at the option to purchase real estate. There are four different paragraphs that are important. In the first paragraph, in the yellow, it talks about the granting of an exclusive right of first refusal and option to purchase. And the first question is that two rights or is that one? Does this document talk about a right of refusal and another right called an option to purchase, or is that simply a sloppy way of describing what this is? The document is entitled Option to Purchase Real Estate. And if we look at the provisions of the document, it is clear that it is not and does not contain a right of first refusal. A right of first refusal has a triggering event. It is a right of first refusal is a dormant option that becomes effective upon a triggering event. If you look at this option to purchase real estate, there is no triggering event. It doesn't say, as some cases involve, if the seller desires to sell the property. It doesn't say if you receive a bona fide offer from a third party. It doesn't have any of those of that type of language. There is no triggering event to trigger a right of first refusal.
But if it's an option that is irrevocable for 15 years, is there really even a triggering event?
I believe there's no triggering event. I believe that if this is anything, it is an option for 15 years, and that option shows clearly that it's not a right of first refusal. And it shows that by, if you look at paragraph 2, the last sentence, and particularly the part in, what is that, mauve? It was red on my computer until I printed it, and then it came out kind of pink. But the last sentence in paragraph 2 says, optionor, Laurel McGilvery, agrees to make available to optionees any contract. Well, that's our first clue that it's not a right of first refusal. If it's a right of first refusal, she's going to make available an offer, not a contract. If she's already entered into a contract, there's no right of first refusal. But she's going to make available to the optionees any contract to purchase a property given to optionor for the purpose of purchasing the property prior to option E exercising their option to purchase the property. Now, that's almost a nonsensical sentence, but what I believe that says is that in the event that option E does not attempt to exercise this option prior to the time that Ms. McGilvery gets a contract on the property, she is required to give them a copy of that contract. There's nothing that says thereafter they can match the terms and conditions of that contract. If, in fact, the furnishing of that contract was a triggering event, then you either exercise the option or you lose it. But if you look at paragraph 5, binding effect, it says this option shall be binding on optionor, her heirs, successors, and assigns, and shall inure to the benefit of option E, its successors, and assigns. Well, who are optionor's assigns? It's Lyndon Stewart. That's who her assign is. So there, the option contained here is binding upon anyone who buys from Laurel McGilvery. That's not consistent at all with a right of first refusal. Matter of fact, it's antithetical to a right of first refusal. Right of first refusal is, I intend to sell the property, buy or don't buy. If you don't buy, you lose your right. Under this document, it's I've already sold the property, here's a copy of the contract, and your option continues for 15 years. Now, in a normal case involving a right of first refusal, we'll see language that says this is how you accept the offer. I'm going to tell you that I intend to accept this offer, and you must do these things to accept my offer. That become, it's a dormant option, now it's a live option, you got to do these things. And most of the time you're going to see time provisions of you have to notify me in 30 days, 60 days, 5 days, 25 days, something of your option, or else it's going to expire. If you look at paragraph 4, Optionee's election to exercise this option shall be by execution and delivery to option or of a contract of sale. But when? On or before the expiration date hereof, November 30, 2022. This is not a right of first refusal.
Why didn't you sue the person you had the contract with for specific performance?
She no longer owns the property. This contract was closed in 5 days from the time that the offer was accepted until it got closed. At the time that by the time we found out it had been closed, she no longer owned the property. And the case law is clear in our briefing that we're entitled to specific performance from the Langdons because they knew of the contract. But if you look at this option, whether or not it is a right of first refusal, which we deny, or an option to purchase, it is illusory. And it's illusory because the purchase price is going to be on terms and conditions that the party can agree upon. And that clearly is unenforceable. That renders this document absolutely meaningless. Now, one of the issues that opposing counsel has raised is that by Exhibit A, the other document that I've given you with colors on it, that we have done two things. We've admitted that there was a right of first refusal. It doesn't say that. And secondly, that there's a condition subsequent because this Exhibit A is subject to the right of first refusal. It doesn't say that. So look, if you look in paragraph one, the parties acknowledge that the property is subject to an option agreement. Doesn't say right of first refusal. It says option agreement. And it doesn't say that the contract that we are submitting, the offer and acceptance that's been delivered, is subject to a right of first refusal. It says the property is subject to, and what that means is the property is burdened by a document that's been filed in the deed records that's going to screw up title for anybody who buys this property. So you got to deal with this document somehow.
It appears from the briefing that there's a dispute as to what Exhibit A actually is or how it was created or what is it an exhibit to?
Exhibit A is an exhibit to the contract between Lyndon Stewart and Laurel McGilvery. It is not an independent document. It is part of the contract. And if you look in the contract itself, it says other documents of the contract. The last one is a box is checked and it says see Exhibit A. So what Exhibit A is, and I'm glad you asked about Exhibit A, here's the impact of Exhibit A, okay? Lyndon Stewart lives on one side of Laurel McGilvery, the Langdons live on the other side, and she wants to sell the property in the middle, and neither, apparently, is willing to offer the price she's asking. So Lyndon Stewart goes to her and says, I'll give you $400,000, and I'll guarantee you $400,000, and we'll subject the property to an auction between me and the Langdons so that I can deal with this title problem, title insurance problem. And whichever is the higher bid at the end of the auction process, you get that. So you get a minimum of $400,000, and you get the highest price that the auction brings. She says, no, I want a minimum of $500,000 and the highest price that the auction brings. Lyndon Stewart says, no, I'll give you $450,000 plus the highest price that the auction brings. And she accepts that offer, signs it, delivers it. We now have an executed and delivered contract for the sale of real estate. The only way we're getting out of that is through a valid right of first refusal. Now, if you look at Exhibit A, paragraph 1, and compare it to the option to purchase, you'll see that the person who prepared Exhibit 1 got it backwards. There, the five-day provision in option to purchase real estate is at such time as the contract is delivered to Laurel McGilvery, then she has 5 days to deliver an executed contract back. Exhibit 1 says, no, the 5 days goes to the Langdons. Exhibit A, insofar as it characterizes the option to purchase, is simply wrong. And our position is that by describing it incorrectly, we don't create a right other than what we created in Exhibit 1. Exhibit 1 creates a right in the Langdons to participate in the auction, and they win the auction if they match the highest bid. They don't have to be the highest bidder, but so long as they match Lyndon Stewart and he doesn't go up, they get the property, and that's the price.
Well, in light of the parole evidence rule, how do we get in to evidence, or did you all, that paragraph 1 is incorrect?
The only way that that's in evidence is through argument of counsel.
Okay.
If you look at Exhibit A and look at this option to purchase, you know that Exhibit A mischaracterizes the option to purchase.
So it's really just a legal argument.
Absolutely.
A basis in law.
Okay. Absolutely. There's nothing in this option to purchase real estate that says that the same terms and conditions as the other offer. That's not there. My time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Mr. Selheimer?
May it please the court. Ed Selheimer on behalf of Joe and Karen Langdon. It's our pleasure to be here today and present this case. The appellant in this case contends that he should be entitled to pay $450,000 at this point in time and have this court order that the Langdons convey the 91 acres that is the subject of this suit to him at this time by invoking an equitable remedy, the equitable remedy of specific performance. To prevail on that appeal, he's got to overcome all five, or at least five, specific legal arguments that were made in the trial court that the trial court could have used to support its decision in denying that relief. And that includes, in doing so, that he's going to have to convince this court that the trial court abused its discretion in failing to grant him the equitable relief of specific performance. And that's because equitable relief is not a matter of right. It is a matter of equity, and the courts have held that when there are no factual disputes, it's a matter that's left to the court, and that decision will not be overturned except in the abuse of discretion. In this case, that's a burden that the appellant, Stewart, cannot, a mountain that he can't climb, in short, because, very simply, equity is not on his side. In this case, you have the Langdons. As you'll look at the record before the court, the Langdons have acted with integrity and in done nothing but comport with the law in enforcing and trying to act on their contractual rights in this matter. The evidence is clear and undisputed that they had an agreement between themselves and their neighbor, Mrs. McGilvery, the person that they originally sold this property to back a number of years earlier, that as long as she owned it, she would give them a right of first refusal and a preferential right to buy the property. And part of the basis for that is that they had acquired the property from Lyndon's uncle, who had tried to have him committed earlier on to take over management of his affairs and had been involved in other litigations with them. And they pleaded with the Langdons never to let Lyndon Stewart, acquire this property. So in honoring their agreement, they, as part of their agreement to sell this property after they purchased it to Mrs. McGilvery, took a right of first refusal. There is no dispute between Mrs. McGilvery and the Langdons that they had a right of first refusal. The equities are that Mr. Stewart knew about that right of first refusal, had actual knowledge. It was recorded in the deed records in 2007. The Langdons, when they found out that Mr. Stewart was going to buy the property, even though it had almost unreasonable conditions that would require them to come up with a cash closing of $450,000 and close within 7 days, that was his contract offer, they elected within 5 days of finding out about that to do that, and that's what they did. They purchased the property for $450,000 in accordance with their agreement with Mrs. McGilvery, their understanding of the agreement, and now own the property. the Langdon's property, their contract that was closed on, is free of mistake and error, and it was clear, it was closed. Because there was a condition subsequent in the contract that they presented, which the appellant in this case basically tried to ignore, the case law, I think, is wholly poorly briefed with their contention that it's not a condition subsequent because of and rely upon a criminal case in which the appellate court had said that a judge rejecting a plea agreement is like a condition subsequent, that you're not bound by the agreement. It is wholly inapplicable to this situation. The case law is clear that a valid right of first refusal, that it, when a contract is subject to a right of first refusal, that is a condition subsequent. And when that contract closes, Mr. Stewart no longer has an agreement. And he specifically acknowledges in his, if they didn't have a right of first refusal, I think an argument could be made that he contractually agreed with Mrs. McGilvery to give them one. The parties acknowledge that the option is subject to an option agreement giving Joe and Karen Langdon the option to purchase property on the same terms as stated in this contract. And that's exactly what they did.
And is that acknowledgement included within the terms of the agreement between McGilvery and Stewart?
Yes, that is Exhibit A, is a contract that Mr. Stewart and his attorney went to the real estate agent, offered, and wrote an offer and attached Exhibit A to their original offer, submitted it to the real estate agent, who then took it to Mrs. McGilvery, who countered at a higher price, and then went back and forth. It's clear that the real estate agent knew about the right of first refusal. Once they had agreed at a price of $450,000, they notified the Langdons. Of course, they notified them by providing them a contract which had the names whited out, so they didn't really know who the parties were, and it was sort of confusing because it turns out that the parties' names were switched and they have them wrong as to who's going to be the buyer and who's going to be the seller on the contract. But they knew that Mrs. McGilvery was wanting to sell the property and that she was willing to take $450,000 and close within a week, and that's what they did.
What effect, if any, does the fact that the closing has taken place, what impact is there on challenging and asserting that the right of first refusal is void or illusory? I mean, performance has been completed.
Well, I think that's one of the equitable considerations. Going back as far as a 1955 case of English versus Jones, the court says you view, in deciding whether to grant or deny specific performance, you view the situation from the part of both parties and decide whether it's more equitable to grant or deny the equitable relief. Certainly to the fact that the Langdons have expended $450,000 and purchased this property in accordance with their agreement on the one side, and the other side you have a party who has out no money because he was refunded his entire purchase price. He's out nothing other than a little time of trying to negotiate this and has suffered no harm under the circumstances. I think that's certainly one of the equitable considerations that the court can and should take into consideration. And I think the other equitable considerations are, as questioned by Judge Dolfino, is you're talking about a party who has no standing to challenge an agreement between McGilvery and the Langdons. Whether it's enforceable or not, a contract between the parties who know what their agreement is and have reached an agreement, there has been even Texas Supreme Court case that I cite in my brief that agreement freely and voluntarily entered into should be treated as sacred and enforced by the courts. And it doesn't matter that it may be that the written memorandum may be unenforceable. That contract is not void. It's not illegal. And Texas courts in Sterner versus Marathon Oil says you can't, that's entitled to protection from the courts. Even an unenforceable contract is entitled to protection. You can't intentionally interfere with someone's contract because it may be unenforceable. That's a tort in Texas law. And it's not equitable in this situation to allow Mr. Stewart to come in and rewrite and claim a valid agreement entered into between two adults that has a legal purpose and that it's now been fully performed should be set aside. And I think perhaps what is most appalling in this instance, is Your Honor, is appellant's contention that he wants to use equity to get this court to approve what I don't see how there's any other way to describe as his sharp practices in trying to put in a condition in his contract that has no other basis, no other reason for being there, and I'm talking about this auction or bidding process, other than to defeat the right of first refusal. They're basically asking this court to condone that as a blueprint on how to avoid a right of first refusal that somebody else has on a property. And if you think through that, I think you'll see Mrs. McGilvery was willing to sell this property for $450,000. Mr. Stewart was willing to buy this property for $450,000. If there hadn't been a right of first refusal, that's what the contract would say. Mrs. McGilvery would have sold it to Mr. Stewart. But there's a right of first refusal. Mr. McGilvery, so they put in a clause that says, okay, if trying to paint the Stewarts into a box, basically, if you accept that clause, you give up your right of first refusal, the right to buy the property at the best price that she was willing to sell it, and then you have to enter into a bidding war with us. That defeats the right of first refusal. If you reject that clause, which is what we did, and which we think under West Texas transmission cases and in those line of cases we have the right to do, we're going to come in and say you didn't properly exercise your right of first refusal. So what we're hoping for is that we have painted you into a box that you'll just walk away from your right of first refusal and then defeat it. And that's what they want this court to say, is that equity condones that, and that if you want to defeat a right of first refusal, this is the way to do it, is you put in a bidding process encourages Mrs. McGilvery or to discourages and prevents the parties from exercising the agreement that they had. And what is that agreement? I mean, this court just a couple of weeks ago, another panel of this court in the FWT case issued an opinion on rehearing on November 25th that says Texas law is clear that a right of first refusal empowers its holder with a preferential right to purchase the subject property on the same terms offered to or by a bona fide purchaser. In this case, what they're saying is either Mr. Stewart or Mr. Langdon or the Langdons ought to be able to purchase this property for $450,000. And they're saying it should not be the party that equity says it's improper and it's even abuse of discretion to allow the party that had a long-standing recorded agreement in which they had the option to purchase that property for the best price available when it was sold. That's wrong, and that's just not the case. If a party is able to purchase this property for $450,000, it ought to be the owner of the preferential right to do so. And there is no disagreement between Mrs. McGilvery and the Langdons about the operation or the fact that they had a preferential right. Thank you very much for your time. If there are no questions.
Thank you, Mr. Steelheimer. Mr. Thompson, rebuttal.
I disagree. Can you believe it? There's no evidence that Laurel McGilvery ever agreed with Lyndon Stewart to sell this property for $450,000 cash. It's a lie. It's not true. It's not supported by the documents. The offer was $450,000 plus an auction. An auction is a time-honored method of disposing of property used in judicial foreclosure sales, sheriff sales, levy on property, you name it. People everywhere are selling property at auction. This is an auction with a reserve of $450,000, a guarantee of $450,000. And for Mr. Seelheimer to come in here and represent that this was a $450,000 cash offer is simply incorrect. Condition subsequent, if you will look at the Exhibit A, the briefing done by Mr. Seelheimer's office says that the language of paragraph 1 is identical to another case that says this is a condition subsequent. But when you look at that other case, you find that that case involves a contract that says this contract is subject to the right of first refusal. Exhibit A says in paragraph 1, the parties acknowledge the property is subject to an option agreement, not that the contract is subject to. And we know that the person preparing Exhibit 1, who, by the way, was not me, knew how to do it properly in paragraph 2. If you look at the red, we see that buyer's offer and this contract is expressly subject to seller's ownership of not less than one half of the mineral estate. So there is a difference in the language in paragraph 1 and paragraph 2. Mr. Seelheimer simply wants to disregard that.
But how can the language of paragraph 1 essentially attempt to modify the original agreement between the optionor and optionee?
Doesn't modify it at all. It doesn't modify it at all. What it says is, I'm willing to buy your property for $450,000 guaranteed, and I will match. If somebody matches that price, I'll go up or you sell to them. So it creates a right in the Langdons they didn't have. But it doesn't change. If they had a right of first refusal, they had a right of first refusal. We don't believe they did. But if they did, then they have to accept the price conditions that are in their option to purchase. The first place you look on a right of first refusal is, what does the document granting that right say? And the document granting that right says the price is what we're going to agree upon later on. And that's illusory. There is no right of first refusal. There's no attempt to change. If there's a right of first refusal, there's a right of first refusal, and they have to accept all of those terms and conditions of the contract unless they're not commercially reasonable. Auction sales are commercially reasonable. They're imposed in bad faith. They're not imposed in bad faith. The seller agreed to that so that she would get the best price possible. The seller agreed to that. It increases the price potentially to her, and she has no risk of losing the sale. And the third one is, was it imposed for the purpose of defeating this right of first refusal? And it wasn't. It doesn't defeat them. This is not an offer that says, I'll give you $450,000 and my calico cat, which you can't possibly do. It says, I will pay you at least $450,000 and I'll match an increase through this auction provision. We may get to $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. And if we do, that's good for you, Ms. Seller. That does not disqualify the Langdons. It does increase the price to them if they choose to go on. But they don't have any ability to say, we don't like how much you agreed to pay. You agreed to pay $450 plus the result of the auction, and we don't like that. So we're going to call it a cash price of $450, and it's simply not that.
But why isn't your cause of action then a claim against McGilvery for breach of Exhibit A?
We want the property. We want the property. The property is next door to the Langdons, next door to Mr. Stewart. It's in between the two. It's not in the summary judgment evidence, but there's gas under the property. Pursuing Laurel McGilvery, where she has moved, you're not going to get what you lose if you don't get this specific property. Thank you very much. My time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Mr. Seelheimer, we appreciate your briefing and your arguments today. Your case is submitted, and we will now adjourn court.